You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, it's the weekly news roundup with a look at indictments against fake electors in Michigan and a possible third-party presidential effort in the works. Those stories and more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, President Biden is out with a new change to student loan repayment plans. That comes after the U.S. Supreme Court last month overturned his previous attempt to eliminate around $400 billion in debt for more than 40 million Americans. The Biden administration says the Saving on Valuable Education, or SAVE, plan will lower monthly payments for people with student loan debt down to $0 in some cases. We're taking a look at the plan, how it works, who would be eligible, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have student loans? How has the restarting of payments affected you? Were you in a little back and forth over the previous plan that got taken down by the U.S. Supreme Court? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Nick Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Happy to be here, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, we last talked to you pretty much right after the U.S. Supreme Court took down that other Biden administration student loan debt forgiveness plan. This is pretty different, but for some people, it might accomplish something similar. Can you give us the broad strokes? What is this thing?
It is an income-driven repayment plan. And what that means is that monthly student loan payments will be connected to the amount of income that somebody who has loans earns. And so basically, it reduces your monthly payment, allows for some cancellation that comes sooner than some of the older plans. And the idea is that this will be done automatically for people who are currently repaying their loans in an income-driven repayment plan.
Right. So an income-driven repayment plan could mean, hey, while you're making less money now, you have lower payments, but you still have to pay the whole thing off eventually as your income goes up. You mentioned there is some forgiveness built into this. It's a little more complicated than, you know, waving a magic wand and taking a number off of your total debt. How does that part of it work?
That's right. So these income-driven plans require borrowers to make payments for 10 years, in some cases 20 or even 25 years. And so the older income-driven plans, those are called income contingent repayment, income-based repayment, and pay as you earn. These are very specific programs that have been created over time. Those programs all have a forgiveness of 20 or 25 years. If you're in those payments plans and you're making payments, eventually those loans will be canceled after several years. There are some ifs and contingencies here, but this new SAVE plan replaces one of them and says, okay, after 10 years, we're going to start forgiving certain debts.
Who is eligible for that kind of, you know, the lower rates of payment and that earlier forgiveness?
Well, that's the big question. So on one hand, we have folks who are currently repaying through one of these income-driven plans. They're going to automatically be moved over to the SAVE plan. So for many people, they don't have to do anything except for maybe recertify when you know they have to. And that old plan is called the revised pay-as-you-earn plan. So there's so much jargon and so much complexity to this. It's hard to kind of explain. But basically, you have one group of folks who will be kind of grandfathered in because they're already in a plan. Then the other group of folks who are not yet in a plan will have to apply. And when they do, they can be eligible for payments that are going to be tied to their income. And sometimes it could be $0 a month that you owe.
I want to be real practical here. Suppose somebody's listening, they have student loan debt. The payments were postponed during COVID. Under the Biden plan, they would have seen some of it forgiven. That's gone away now because of the Supreme Court. They aren't making a ton of money, so they think they might be eligible. What do they do? Do they go? They can't apply yet, but when this kicks in, how do they apply? What do we know about that? Or does it just happen?
You'll have to apply if you're not already in the system, basically. So when you apply, you go to the federal U.S. Department of Education's website. You make an application. You can do all this through your loan servicer. That loan servicer is a company that that's the one that you make your payments to every month. And between the parties, you'll be able to make your application and get into this repayment plan. And then you have to have undergraduate direct loans or graduate direct loans. And those are very specific terms that are federal loans. So if you, for example, borrowed from a bank or a credit union or some other private entity, those would not qualify. It has to be a federal direct loan.
Talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison, looking at a new student loan debt repayment rule from the Biden administration that allows lower payments, sometimes as low as zero, and the potential for earlier forgiveness. You can join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Pat, hi.
Greetings. Thank you for taking my phone call and happy Friday. Okay, my son is a graduate of the UW system. He's got a master's and he's got a huge pile of student debt. My problem is when you buy a house or you buy a car, you take out a loan and you're expected to pay that money back. He took out a loan and he realizes that yes, he has to pay that money back. I'm sorry, I know this probably sounds mean, but I don't think that it's fair that they're gonna say, we'll let you go.
Pat, I gotcha. And Pat's not alone, Nick. Concerns about fairness, not just compared to other kinds of loans, but to someone who, you know, has already paid off a student loan or found other means to pay. That's been a concern with this talk of student loan debt forgiveness all along, right?
That's absolutely right. And there have been over the years, not just under the Biden administration, but under conservative and more liberal administrations over the years, there have been a lot of interest in public service loan forgiveness. So folks who go into public services like teaching or nurses or so on, or work with a nonprofit organization, these jobs typically don't pay a whole lot, but you need a college degree to work in those positions. There have been some carve outs over time for these loan forgiveness plans for people who are in the public sector. And so there are definitely politics here and issues of fairness. And there are also kind of like protected groups that policymakers have over time tried to benefit. And we see now in the current debates, it's not just about public service loan forgiveness. It's bigger than that now.
Thanks a lot for that call, Pat. With the public service loan forgiveness, a related story here. There's been reporting from NPR over the last bunch of years that people who probably should be eligible for that kind of debt forgiveness aren't getting it, largely because of red tape. The Biden administration also making a push to get more people who thought they were going to get debt forgiveness because of that public service you mentioned actually get it. What are you watching for there, Nick?
That's right. There are two parts to this. One, you're absolutely right. This public service loan forgiveness has gone through a lot of fixes over the past couple of years. And I looked up some data for the state of Wisconsin. And in Wisconsin, probably about a year and a half or 2 years ago, there have been almost 10,000 individual borrowers who have had their debts forgiven under this public service loan forgiveness plan. And so that's on one hand of the equation. That totals to about $600 some million. And on the other hand, you have some other cancellation that the Biden administration has been working on for students who have gone to a college and that college defrauded them. There are many colleges out there, too many, that promise a particular career path or they promise a particular experience and you don't get it. And in these cases, it's possible to have the college defraud students. And under certain circumstances, you can have your loans forgiven if you were defrauded. And so in Wisconsin, about 200 applications have been approved for this borrower defense cancellation, and that's another $41 million. There's been another recent fix that canceled even more. So there will be these targeted approaches that affect people in Wisconsin here and there.
Let's go back to our callers. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on the program. Yes, I would have to say that I would disagree with the previous caller. It's one thing if you are able to finance your education with the subsidized federal loans. Typically, the interest rates is lower, and then you don't start paying interest until you get out of college. But those other loans that the interest rates are higher, and you start paying interest immediately, And then you pay interest on interest. You've heard those horrible stories about people who pay, are paying on their loans their whole lives and never get them paid off. I mean, part of the difficulty is that we are not investing in education as a state. We're 47 or 43 out of the 50 United States. I mean, it's really a crisis. I work in higher ed. I have for almost 20 years. And when you talk to students who are paying 9% interest, and this was at the time
when rates were lower. Christine, I gotcha. I want to give Nick a quick moment before you take a break. Nick, your thoughts on what Christine brought up?
Oh, totally right. Interest capitalization is a big problem with some of the existing income-driven repayment plans, and that has created payments to balloon and the debt to balloon for a lot of borrowers. And this new SAVE program is designed to stop that from happening. One of the features of this new SAVE program we haven't talked about yet is that it ends interest capitalization. So your loan will not continue to balloon if you're in this program.
Thanks for the call, Christine. Talking to Nick Hillman with UW-Madison, getting an update on student loans, repayments restarting, the latest on the Biden administration's SAVE plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, or experiences. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Nick Hillman, professor of educational leadership and policy analysis at UW-Madison, looking at student loans and the Biden administration's latest attempts at offering some level of loan forgiveness. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Josh is with us in Minnesota. Josh, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. I had a question. So my wife has a significant amount of student loans, and she was on a 30-year repayment plan. And then after that court ruling, it switched to a 10-year income-based plan. And I was wondering if I heard you right earlier that she may become eligible in the future to switch back to a 30-year repayment plan. And hers is specifically a public service plan for work at a hospital, if that is all adding up for you.
Josh, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, these are complicated things that you may not be able to give specific advice, but based on what you're seeing, what do you have for Josh?
Yeah, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program has two criteria. Obviously, being in the public service, but you've got to make qualifying payments. You've got to make 120 of these qualifying payments. And one of those types of qualifying payments would be under a standard 10-year repayment plan. Well, if you make payments for 10 years, your loan's going to be gone anyway. So you kind of, the other side of this is the income-driven repayment plan. So for the caller, if anybody's interested in these public service loan forgiveness programs, they've got to be in one of these income-driven repayment plans to be able to benefit from it.
Thanks a lot for that call. I want to get into one part of this we haven't talked about yet, Nick, when it comes to student loan delinquency and default. I want to give a listen to President Biden introducing the plan and talking about that part of it.
Normally, this could lead borrowers to fall into delinquency and default. But without their financial security, it would hurt their financial security, and that's not good for them or the economy. That's why we're creating a temporary 12-month, what we're calling on-ramp repayment program. And now, this is not the same as a student loan pause. It's been in effect for the past 3 years. Monthly payments will be due. Bills will not go out, and interest will be accruing. And during this period, if you can pay your monthly bills, you should. But if you cannot, if you miss payments, this on-ramp will temporarily remove the threat of default or having your credit harm, which can hurt borrowers for years to come.
Okay, so this big pause ends. Here's this on-ramp. How are you seeing that work, Nick?
Well, it's really a necessity to turn this pause back on, to end the pause. There's going to be a lot of disruption. I think that this on-ramp is going to at least help smooth some of that out. It has one complication, though, for policymakers who are interested in accountability. One of the major federal accountability tools is measuring and also sanctioning colleges according to how well their former students repay their loans. And if too many students fall into default, colleges can be sanctioned for that. And so what this on-ramp does is it helps people, which is the priority, and it makes it more complicated for these existing federal policy and accountability tools to really have an impact, because This means that, you know, for the next 12 months and then even a year after that, we're not going to really see any delinquencies and default, which is a good thing, but it could be sort of hiding some of the underlying problems that we know exist in our higher education system.
What kind of numbers do we have, Nick, on how many people in Wisconsin are going to be affected by this this on-ramp concept?
Well, I don't have an exact number of people in Wisconsin who will be affected by it, but I do know this. There are about 700,000 total borrowers out there who will be affected one way or another. And that's about one in five adults or so. And they usually carry on average about $30,000 in student loan debt, sums up to about $22 billion. So it's a big, you know, student loans are a big issue in the state of Wisconsin and nationally. In this on-ramp, it's going to benefit a sizable share of folks. There are going to be folks who aren't going to really need the on-ramp, and there are some who will really need it. And that's what it's there for, is just to help kind of with that transition to make sure that there's some flexibility in the system so that that borrowers can get back on their feet and make those payments.
Talking to Nick Hillman about student loan debt, a new repayment plan option coming from the White House. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Angie is with us in Madison. Angie, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So this is kind of specific, but I am a postdoctoral fellow, and I don't know if your guest is familiar with this situation, but essentially the granting agency pays the fellowship, and so I don't have employee status at the university that I'm essentially working for. So I've lost now 36 months of qualifying public service loan forgiveness payments despite essentially working full-time for university because of my non-employee status. So I've contacted my elected officials, kind of let them know about this like weird negative loophole, but I was wondering if your guest has any organizations that are kind of actively working on this in mind that I can contact just to really raise awareness about this problem.
Interesting, Angie. Thanks for the call. Nick, it is pretty specific. Anything you're seeing from the Biden administration on this or that you know is out there working on this?
A couple of organizations do come to mind, but I'm not sure if they will address this specifically. But one is the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, the CFPB, a federal agency that is designed to just help address some of these issues. And another is a nonprofit organization that really sprung up over the recent years around debt cancellation, the Student Borrower Protection Center. And so possibly one of those organizations could not just help with this specific one, but anybody who's asked questions or who might have issues about their situations. It might be worth connecting with those groups.
Thanks a lot for that call. Woody joins us now in Green Bay. Woody, hi.
Yep. I feel that these people should not be forgiven a debt. Or how about the people that paid theirs off? Should they get a refund?
Woody, thanks a lot for the call. Again, getting back to, I think, the fairness issue, Nick, if someone has borrowed the same amount of money but paid it off, are they, in effect, being ripped off here?
You know, that's where this gets so politicized and understandably so. And it's not going to end with this Supreme Court decision. It's not going to end this election cycle. In fact, I would bet that the next election cycle, this whole debt cancellation is going to become a wedge issue. And so kind of buckle up for that, because it does speak to those issues of fairness. And at the same time, it speaks to the way that our states and our federal government support higher education or don't. Financially, there's a lot more burden on individuals to pay for college. And if we're expecting them to pay for college through student loans, our student loan system was basically designed in the 1960s and early 1970s, not for the issues that we're facing today. So there's sort of this clash of government, a clash of politics. And at the end of the day, it's affecting 44 million people. And so it's becoming just a really big issue.
Woody, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Nick, you're not a lawyer, but you dug deep into that Supreme Court decision that overturned the previous plan. Any hints as to whether this might be seen as more able to pass court muster than that other one?
That is the big question. In fact, I think one big hint is that already a group of senators and U.S. House members have put together a letter signed by 70 individuals. They're all Republicans who claim that the Department of Education and the Biden administration does not have authority to implement the SAVE program. And they've already invoked the Supreme Court decision, basically saying that the Department of Education has overstepped its authority, that if there were to be the kind of cancellation that the Biden administration has rolled out, then it has to have been legislated through congressional action. And so the question is whether congressional action is clear enough. And that's what we just saw with the Supreme Court decision. It wasn't clear enough. Here we go again. But in this case, I think it's probably a safer bet that this will pass and be able to proceed. But again, I'm not a lawyer. That's right. Just my two cents.
And Nick, just briefly, I asked you this last time too. Thoughts on, you know, making college more affordable in the first place so people don't rack up the debt in the first place?
You know, there are so many factors, but some big ones are, of course, tuition is expensive. And to keep tuition down at public institutions, that means that we have to have appropriations to cover that. So that's a big part. And it's been contributing to why students borrow, because college is more expensive in general. But it's not just tuition. It's also the cost of living, the housing and the food and other kind of necessities that it takes to be able to enroll in college and take time off of work if necessary, or care for childcare, you know. So all these things kind of add up, and those are things you're eligible to borrow student loans for. And so one of the big factors, I guess two of the big factors, are that college is expensive, and so are the non-tuition expenses, but also family incomes have been just zapped. There's been a cliff in terms of that kind of growth that we've seen over time. And so families are more constrained today than before in many cases. So you have a lot of things happening that all contribute to steady and growing demand for student loans.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's Nick Hillman, professor at the UW-Madison Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis. We've been talking about the latest on student loans and President Biden's attempts to offer some loan forgiveness. Tomorrow here on Central Time, some federal health programs now require re-enrollment after a multi-year break. Find out who that affects and what you and loved ones need to know. That and more Monday here on Central Time. Computer-generated content is rapidly changing the terms of what's possible. Whether it's text or images or videos, a growing number of people have access to these tools. As companies that develop so-called artificial intelligence software make it accessible to the public, that can have the unintended consequence of enabling bad actors, including people who stand to profit from creating and sharing illicit content. Some recent research by the Wall Street Journal, Stanford University, and the University of Massachusetts Amherst revealed Instagram's algorithms connecting and promoting a network of accounts sharing underage sexual content. Stanford's Internet Observatory also recently co-authored a report with the group Thorn, a nonprofit that builds technology to defend children from sexual abuse. This report focused on the prevalence of people using improved machine learning to create photorealistic, sexually exploitative images of children. One of the co-authors of that report joins us now, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions, what concerns do you have about the potential risks of this AI-generated content on social media? If you're a young person or maybe a parent, guardian, grandparent, what questions do you have about keeping kids safe online? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rebecca Portnoff is Director of Data Science for the group Thorn. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
I gave a very brief description of Thorn. Can you tell us some more about what the group does and specifically what you as part of the data science team do there?
Absolutely. So as you said, Thorn is a NGO that is dedicated to building technology to combat child sexual abuse. We believe in a strategy that allows for three different main intervention points. One is around supporting victim identification. Two is around stopping re-victimization. So this is now the spread of child sexual abuse material where a child's abuse is documented in image or video and then shared out. And then finally, prevention, stopping that abuse from happening in the first place. So I lead the data science team at Thorn. We are the department that builds the machine learning and artificial intelligence technology that powers a lot of our interventions across these three different intervention points.
And as you mentioned, you use AI, among other tools, as part of the prevention techniques. But you also have a concern that in addition to the already existing CSAM, child sexual abuse imagery, we are going to see an emergence of AI-generated CSAM. what should we know that we might not even be aware of in the public?
That's right, Rob. I would say that in general, technology is a double-edged sword, that it can be certainly used for good purposes and with good outputs, but that it also, unfortunately, can be used to harm or to further harms. So when it comes specifically to generative AI technology, what we are observing is that there is a small but growing amount of AI-generated or machine learning-enabled CSAM. That's what I mean here is content that has been synthetically generated using some of these diffusion models, these generative AI technologies, that sometimes these images are do not represent the exact likeness of a known child, but sometimes they do, and that in either case, this kind of material has some serious potential ramifications on the child safety ecosystem.
And if I understand things correctly, Congress, in one way, got out ahead of this. Creating this kind of imagery with a computer is illegal as it stands right now. Do I have that right?
That is my current understanding, that there is legislation that covers from either a CSAM or a obscenity perspective this kind of content.
Now, as you say, this is newer technology. It's emerging. We're seeing what's going to happen out there. You are hoping to get out ahead of this in ways that we maybe didn't with social media. What kind of things are you looking for when it comes to the creators of these artificial intelligence, especially these image and video generation kinds of software?
Thorne really sees this as an opportune moment to prioritize safety by design in the development and the deployment and the maintenance of these kind of technologies. So when you think about the machine learning or AI life cycle, it really includes these three core elements where you are building the classifiers, you're then deploying these classifiers, making them available for use, and then finally you're maintaining these classifiers. And in all cases, we see strong opportunities to prioritize child safety.
How would that work in practice? So I know people not doing exploitative imagery might say, you know, type in the parameters, give me a picture of a dragon flying over New York City or whatever. And the program will use its training, come up with an image that looks kind of like that. Now, that's fine. What kind of things could we do to say if somebody's giving instructions that would aim at the output of exploitative child imagery, like can you put a roadblock? Can you put limiters on this kind of software to say, nope, not going to output that?
That's a great question. So at the end of the day, a lot of this comes down to mitigations, things that we can do to reduce the risk, not necessarily eliminate the risk, but just to get a little bit more tangible. If I talk about development, a very concrete action item that companies can take and that many have taken is to ensure that their training material, so the data that is used to build these classifiers, that it has already been cleaned of any kind of abusive CSAM or other kind of abusive content, that this then makes it more difficult for the model to get misused downstream to produce this type of content. If we talk about deploying these mechanisms, you know, you mentioned that someone could input some text and then output an image. If you have these models deployed in a controlled environment, then you could incorporate detection at the inputs and outputs where you, for example, might disallow particular prompts or particular requests that are, you know, clearly trying to generate AIG CSAM, and then also check at the outputs whether or not the prompt has been successful in generating that kind of content and then disallow it if so.
We're talking to Rebecca Portnoff, Director of Data Science for Thorne, looking at exploitative images of kids on social media, on the internet. It's there already, of course, sadly. And now AI-generated imagery and videos are starting to follow. She's calling for early interventions to keep it from spreading too quickly. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about what this is, what's going, what we can do to prevent it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Rebecca, I want to take this to, most people aren't going to be programming these kind of things and at the front lines of this fight. But lots of people have kids who are encountering things online, or grandkids, or you name it. Do you have thoughts for people to help protect their kids from being exposed to this kind of imagery, maybe even interacting with the networks that share this kind of imagery?
You know, this may sound a bit cliche, but the reality is that we are in a different world than we used to be, that kids these days are growing up with that phone in their hands, that they're exploring their identities both on and offline. And so certainly Thorn recognizes this and has resources available like our Thorn for Parents that helps equip parents with the skills and resources that they need to have important, productive, and judgment-free conversations to prevent abuse. In general, we say, talk early to your kids about this. Talk often. Continue to build that trust.
Getting back to the companies now, looking back at the growth of social media, it seemed like we were years behind on catching up with a variety of bad things spreading on social media. Are there lessons that you think we can learn at the outset now with this AI coming along that that we can learn from the slower start we got back in the early days of social media?
This, to me, returns back to that idea of safety by design. We built an internet without child safety in mind, and we really have an opportunity in this moment to get ahead with generative AI. It's still fairly nascent. It's still fairly early, and we can seize this opportunity to prioritize child safety and how we build this technology.
We're talking to Rebecca Portnoff, Data Science Director for Thorn. That's a nonprofit that builds technology aimed at defending children from sexual abuse. We're talking about a new report she co-wrote looking at how advances in machine learning, things you may see referred to as artificial intelligence, these things could be used to generate and distribute images of child sexual abuse. Talking about how to get out ahead of that, what to happen, what to do as it starts to spread. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this a story that's impacted you in some way? Have you or your kids or grandkids encountered some type of abusive material online, maybe on a social media platform? And what questions do you have about the technology that can be used, abused, and then maybe used to target these problems? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about AI, so-called artificial intelligence, being used potentially to generate images of child sexual abuse and how people like our guest are working with machine learning to counteract and intervene before the problem gets worse. Rebecca Portnoff is with us. She's Director of Data Science for the group Thorn. We have a link to Thorn's website and to that report we mentioned over at WPR.org/Central Time. And you can join the conversation with your thoughts, your questions about all this at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. Well, I might be putting ideas in somebody's mind, but somebody probably thought of it already. But what I thought of with this came up with is some perverts are likely to take a child's picture and put that into pornography. So the child isn't necessarily physically victimized, but could be visually or sexual or socially victimized. So somebody might think, well, gee, this child was in this, but it's just something that's artificial.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And Rebecca, Dennis is not wrong, right? Pete, this is definitely a concern.
That's correct. It's definitely a concern. In fact, it's something that we know is actively happening today. And Dennis, while it's really horrific to reflect on, some bad actors are even using that type of material to then further extort these children for financial gains. They will send them this doctored content that depicts their face, their likeness in these pornographic settings, and then use it to extort them for blackmail or for money. So it's really quite troubling what's happening today.
Dennis, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Chad joins us now in Sauk City. Chad, hi.
Hi, how's it going? I just had a comment about, I was listening to your program, and I just honestly don't think there's anything that can be done to prevent the spread of AI with the creation of anything that anybody can imagine. And I just don't see there's any way to stop that.
Chad, thanks for the call. Rebecca, I'm guessing, given your line of work, you don't share Chad's complete pessimism on this.
Yeah, Chad, I'm going to have to disagree. I think that what we're seeing in the data is that when it comes to AI-generated CSAM, it is a growing problem, but it's still small. That we do have the opportunity to intervene, to prioritize safety by design in the development to make it much more difficult for these kinds of classifiers to produce this kind of content. And when it comes to CSAM, not AIG content now, but CSAM, I can say definitively that the work that Thorne and our partner organizations have done have had impact in real children's lives to stop the re-victimization with the use of their content and to help prevent that abuse.
Chad, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Eric joins us next, calling from Portage. Eric, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Eric?
Hey, two questions. One, first of all, how is this a thing? And secondly, as regular civilians, what can we do to help? Because this is shocking.
Eric, thanks for the call. What can everyday people, Rebecca, do to help? Eric wants to know.
I appreciate you asking, Eric. I would say that there are a lot of good organizations that are supporting this kind of work that will certainly not turn down donations and those kinds of financial support. I think that if you're looking to understand the issue better, looking at our Thorne for Parents resources and other resources that our awesome research and insights team have made available on our website is also a really good way to learn more and then to share that knowledge out with others.
Thanks for the call, Eric. We're talking to Rebecca Portnoff, Director of Data Science for the group Thorne, talking about imagery, child exploitative imagery, child sexual abuse imagery on the internet. It's already there. And now artificially intelligence generated CSAM, child sexual abuse imagery on the way. Talk about ways to get ahead of that. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions or thoughts on this. A related question, Rebecca, if somebody encounters something like this, they're on a social media site and they see something that seems like it's advertising this kind of exploitative imagery, or a young person, a parent finds out their kid has been blackmailed, like you said, who do you report these things to? How do we reach out to authorities?
The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, also known as NCMEC, is the clearinghouse for these kinds of reports. And I would certainly say that that is the right place to go to submit a report to them, that their website is missingkids.org.
I understand the AI-generated imagery could complicate that. Now, if these reports come in, not only do we have this horrific report, this horrific imagery, we have to figure out, okay, are we tracking down a real kid being exploited or an artificially generated image that we need to track down? How complicated is that going to be?
That's where the ecosystem comes into play, this understanding that if you know that this content is synthetic, market as such, and then share that information, share those signals with the broader child safety ecosystem. Law enforcement already has a tremendous caseload. That's why we're working so hard to get ahead of this.
Now, a lot of this we're concerned about here in the United States. Of course, the internet is global. How much does that complicate efforts to track down and then stop the spread of this kind of material?
I would say that regulatory distinctions across the world certainly do make this problem more complex. In general, when it comes to making a difference here, what we have seen is that it requires that global response, that global coordination in order to make a difference in these kids' lives.
What kind of technologies are on your radar that you're particularly concerned about? You're particularly hopeful that their creators will start to take some of those steps towards safety by design?
Certainly, generative AI is front of mind for us at this moment, both when it comes to opportunities to use this technology to further good, to use it in some of the existing machine learning workflows that we have, as well as all that we've been discussing when it comes to the way it can be misused. In general, what we say is that every content hosting platform, every platform with a upload button can and likely does host volumes of CSAM. And so making that a priority for your organization is key.
What kind of tools are out there? I know you work with individual social media companies, but in general, what kind of tools are out there? How do they spot this material? Is it all based on user reports? Do they have humans? Is it algorithm programs searching? How is this stuff detected by a social media platform?
So there's a concept of proactive and reactive detection. Both are important. When I say reactive, it is exactly that user reporting that you're referring to. When I talk about proactive detection, that is proactively looking out for those instances of abuse. So Thorn has an industry tool called SAFER that we offer to platforms that's designed to help technology companies detect, review, and report this kind of abuse imagery at scale.
And we've talked a lot about the AI software creators, some about the social media platforms, some about the end users, the parents out there. Do you see a need for changes either in law or in regulation and enforcement of current laws as we look at the impact of these AI-created images and videos?
You know, I'm not a policy person. I am a data scientist. I will say that the tools that we have at hand, I want to make sure that we are encouraging the ecosystem to use every tool that we have at hand to tackle this problem.
And I want to come back to the resources now you have available at Thorn. Again, we've got a link at wpr.org/centraltime. And this is something I imagine could be used for parents, by educators and others. Go into some detail. What kind of things will people find there if they go looking for help?
Well, one resource I'd like to highlight is No Filter. This is our youth-focused prevention program that seeks to increase awareness among youth about the risk of sharing nudes online, to help change some toxic attitudes that shame victims, and just in general, provide the knowledge and tools that they need to resist online threats. Of course, you can go to thorn.org to learn more about the issue holistically, and then parents.thorn.org includes talking tips and conversation starters for parents who are wanting to engage with their children in a healthy way.
And I think an impression parents might have is, okay, well, I hear about this stuff on the dark web. You know, my kids are just on Instagram and Snapchat or whatever. The problem is sometimes when we stumble into the wrong corners of our social media, that's what leads us into these darker off the map places. How much of a concern is that?
I think that I would share some statistics from NCMEC. In 2001, they received just 421 reports of CSAM. In 2021, that number grew to more than 84 million. So the sad reality is that this content is everywhere. And that's why it's so important to talk early to your kids. These kids are growing up online, and it's important to give them what they need in order to be able to explore in a safe and healthy way.
Rebecca, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks again for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
We've been talking to Rebecca Portnoff, Director of Data Science for the group Thorn. We talked to her today about some of the ways artificial intelligence can be used to create and share images of child sexual abuse and how to prevent that from happening and crack down on it when it does. Again, we've got links to resources with Thorn. You can find them at wpr.org/centraltime. That's wpr.org/centraltime.